There is some core elements of the creation that are so fundamental that without them, life and creation would not exist. These are often called essential elements. Science tells us there are 118 of them in the periodic tables. 19 of them are required for human life to exist. It's kind of an interesting concept that there can be just really a handful of core pieces that make up life. For your physical life and my physical life, it's 19 things in our bodies that make our life up. Now again, they're essential. There's a few traits that are like, yeah, you really should have that. But again, you can live with just 19 elements in you. We often refer to things like essential vitamins. Without them, you can't live either. They're part of the 19. It's what makes us up. All matter is made up of atoms. It's a simple item in one sense. It's got protons, neutrons, electrons, and magnetic fields, or chemical bonds that hold it together. Change any one of those, and the atom is not what it was. I think it's, my daughter's going through this, so I'm overhearing all the science stuff in the background. It's like helium, I think, has one electron and one proton. You add one, and it becomes
hydrogen.
It's an amazing thing, one little thing, and it's no longer what it was. It's essential that it has just one if you want to keep it helium. So again, there's this concept of essential components that make us make things what they are. And without them, it simply wouldn't be what it is. Similarly, and I do mean similarly, I just referred to a bunch of physical things, but there are attributes of our God that are essential. There are things with our God that He would not be God without. Many of which we talk about all the time. We know. Love. Think about it. If God was not the epitome of perfection of love, He couldn't be God. He wouldn't be God. He'd be something else. He'd be something less. Substantially less on that front. Omniscient. All-knowing. If He didn't know everything, well, He wouldn't be God. If He didn't know, as the Bible refers to it, hairs on head, sparrows falling, He knows everything. That's our God. If He didn't know that, then He wouldn't be God. Omnipotent, this all-powerful concept. All power emanates from Him. It's like, in some regards, it's the grace concept. All of it came from Him. All of it. Every government entity has their power. Stars and planets and galaxies have their power and have the nuclear reactions and fission and fusion. And all of that came from a God. He has it all. Some that, again, we are very familiar with, holy. I won't go into all of these. Righteousness, merciful, gracious. If He wasn't those things, then He wouldn't be our God. And I personally lean on the last two quite heavily. Be in grace. I think we like to think about those. We lean on those. We rely on them, as the special music showed us on one of them. We rely on those. There is one of the divine perfections that does not sufficiently get pondered by Christians. But it is one that is absolutely, every bit as much as the rest, essential to God being who He is. And it's the one we want to discuss today. I want to start over in Deuteronomy chapter 32. Moses refers to this attribute in the song he left for Israel just prior to his death. We're just going to read the introduction because I think it's interesting. It's the first thing Moses really leans on to go on and really tell Israel a bunch of their future. I'm not going to read the whole thing. He's basically, you need to remember what your God did for you. And by the way, you're likely to walk away from Him. And he proved the psalm really to be a prophecy of what Israel was going to do. But Moses predicated much of his conversation on this attribute. And again, we don't always sufficiently ponder the attribute. So Deuteronomy chapter 32, we'll start in verse 1. He says, "Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak. And hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teachings drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herb and the showers on the grass. For I proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are justice, a God of truth, and without injustice, righteous and upright is he. The first thing Moses mentions is God is a rock. God, it's a personification, really. But God is an immovable, unchangeable God. He's immutable, is the theological term that gets labeled on this. But he's unchangeable. Physically, everything we know changes. The galaxies, the universes will change. They are changing right now. God's not like that. He created all that, but he is a rock. Again, it's a good personification. It's a good metaphor for us to think through. And I kind of envision this, a rock out in the middle of the ocean. Everything tumultuous around, it just sits there. We may come and we may go. Universes may come and go. And we'll read some of that later. But God is the rock that stays there for all of it. I think it's interesting. It's a little bit outside the scope of the message today. But verse 5, Moses launches right into sort of that, in my metaphor, that ocean component. Because he jumps into the people. Verse 5, just again, we'll read it for an interesting juxtaposition between verse 4 and verse 5. He says, they have corrupted themselves. The first thing he says is, all the people have corrupted themselves. They have changed. All the people have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish. It's a blight to God. He says they're a perverse and crooked generation. Again, it's an interesting juxtaposition in just two verses. And I think, again, it lays, the reason I wanted to start here is it lays the foundation for the rest of this message. On one hand, we have a rock. And on the other hand, we have people, all of us, since Adam and Eve, have corrupted ourselves to some degree. We have changed. Now, again, we have the benefit we can change for the good and bad. God's not that way. He's the perfect personification. He is the perfection of every one of his attributes. And again, it can be hard to wrap our minds around it a little bit because, it's a lot like trying to understand infinity. It hurts after a while, even though you keep going, you keep trying to get bigger and bigger. But he is perfect love. He is perfect justice. And again, the topic we're talking about today is his immutability. He doesn't change. And that has such a profound implication for yours and my life. And again, that's what we want to really get to today. I want to turn over to James chapter 1. I want to go through just a few key scriptures that come right out, quite frankly, and talk about God's immutability. Highlight a few key verses, but really what I want to get into is to talk about the implications of God's immutability to you and to me and to all Christians and all humanity in time. So James chapter 1. We'll read verses 16 through 18. James says, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Again, there's no variation to our God. There's not even a shadow of turning. All the commentaries that I read, anyway, which I shouldn't say all. That sounds like I read them all. I read one or two, but they agreed. So, and it makes sense. But again, here's our God. He's unchanged. The idea of light. He is a Father of lights. He's comparing it to the sun and the rotation of the earth and the variation of the sun from season to season, just horizontally and vertically across the earth's axis. It's saying there isn't any of that. Even what we consider so steady, so normal. Throughout the day, that shadow shifts, it turns, it moves, that slightest little increment. That's not the way our God is. Every time you approach our God, he's the same. Every time you pray, you're praying to exactly the same God. You're praying to the exact same God Moses talked with. All the disciples talked with. Paul talked with. You today are talking. He's no different. In one little way, he's no different than he was back then. The word in Greek is paralogē, if I say it right, which probably doesn't. But it's the only place it's found in the New Testament. Again, they go on and they talk about the whole concept of the rising and the settings and the shifting of the seasons. In that sense, there is no sun, rising and setting of the sun. And I do find it a little bit interesting. It's probably well off this and no correlation, but when Christ is here, there will be no need for sun nor moon, for the light will be here. And I would guess there'll be no shadow of turning, quite literally, if you don't need a sun to illuminate. Interesting side note, but I do want to read a comment from Barnes Note, which is one of the commentaries I read. It says, he's always the same at all seasons of the year and in all ages. There is no change in his character, his mode of being, his purpose and plans. What he was millions of ages before the worlds were made, he is now. What he is now, he will be countless millions of ages hence. We may be sure that whatever changes there may be in human affairs, whatever reverses we may go under, whatever oceans we may cross, whatever mountains we climb, or in whatever worlds we may hereafter take up our abode, God is the same. Again, it's, brethren, it's this whole concept of directly tying it to something that we view as so stable. Again, the sun was here millions of years before humans were created. According to science, it'll be here millions of years after we're gone. But God will be the same. Verse 18, of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. It's an important point. I just want to highlight, of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth. It was his will, and we'll talk about this later, but this has a direct impact on his immutability. I shouldn't say it has an impact on his immutability. The immutability has an impact on that concept, that he brought us forward by the word of truth. And just, I don't want to have to turn back here, so let's squirrel that one in the back of your mind. Hebrews 13, verse 8. This one's a quick one. I think most of you are familiar with it, so we don't even need to turn there if you want it for your notes. Hebrews 13:8 says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Straightforward. He's the same. Malachi 3, verse 6 is in the same boat. It's a one verse. For I am the Lord. I do not change. He doesn't change. And I find the rest of the verse interesting, because he's saying, therefore, you are not consumed, O sons of Jacob. Because at this point, they'd given him every reason to consume them. But he's saying, I don't change. I have a purpose. I have a plan. I'm not changing from it. Therefore, I've not consumed you. So again, there are multiple scriptures. There's just a quick survey of three of the big ones that often get used in reference to the immutability of God. So I ask a question as we kind of unpack this one. In what ways is God immutable? How would our God be unchangeable? I came up with three very overarching ways. Broad, big categories. A lot of immutability concept or unchanging concepts fit within that. Essentially, because again, this is such an essential element, all of God's attributes roll under these. All of them. Because he's unchanging in all of them. And again, as we'll discover as we go on, you and I, whether we sort of stop to ponder or not, bank on that. We bank on the fact that he will not change. And again, we'll get to that concept a little later. The first category I have is he is immutable in his essence. He's immutable. I'm going to slur that word the whole day, aren't I? See, I could blame it on the allergies I'm suffering through right now. I don't know. I got like a headache on this side, just so everybody feels like my eyes being pulled back a bit. Anyway, but he's immutable in his essence, in his being, and who he is. The book of Hebrews introduces us to this key aspect. If we would, turn over to Hebrews chapter 7. Hebrews chapter 7, I want to start in verse 1. And this is referring to Melchizedek, but again, it makes a very interesting observation on the essence and the being of our Creator. For this Melchizedek, again, Hebrews 7, verse 1, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all. first being translated King of Righteousness, then also King of Salem, meaning King of Peace. Again, great titles for Christ, or our God. Verse 3, he says, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. It's a great summary of who our God is. Great summary of the firstborn Son of God. And the writer of Hebrews, most likely Paul, started the book out with the same kind of thought. Same, similar thought. I want to turn back now and read Hebrews chapter 1. So here we have a God in his essence, neither beginning of days nor end of life, no father, no mother, no genealogy. In essence, above time. I mean, again, we know he created the physical universe, which in essence started what we would call time. Again, some of these, as I was thinking through this and preparing it, I kept getting into that infinity thing. I'm like, how do you get, I don't know what it's like to not have time. I don't know how to consider that. I just know that's the case. He eternally existed before time did. So again, let's dive into Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. Again, this is a description of the firstborn Son of God. It says, God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in times past by the prophet or by the Father, to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds. So again, he made it all. And being in the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power. Again, I wish we could have time or had the time to unpack some of these specific concepts. But he upholds all things by the word of his power. That alone says an enormous amount about our God. When he had by himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become so much better than the angels, as he has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. For to which of the angels did he ever say, you are my son, today I have begotten you? And again, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. But when he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all the angels of God worship him. And of the angels he says, who makes his angels spirits and his ministers a flame of fire. But to the Son he says, so here's God saying to Christ the Son, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is a scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions. And you, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Consider that. Just again, everything we know about science, work of his hand. You know, it's often this image that he can hold everything that physically there is in the palm of his hands. But he created it all. The heavens are the works of his hand. Verse 11, they will perish. All of that's going to go away. They will all disappear. But you will remain. And they will grow old like a garment. Like a cloak, you will fold them up. And they will be changed. But you are the same. And your years will not fail. That's the essence. It highlights really the essence of our God. Outside of the physical component, outside of all we know, he's going to take all the universe. What we know is, you know, science, again, I assume they're right. I assume they can calculate the growth of the universe and figure out how, you know, how much long at that rate it's been around. Millions and billions of years. To God, and in the past, and millions and billions of years in the future, to God it's like changing a coat. Think about that. We do that without thinking. I'm like, go home, put on a coat, go out, come back in, I'm going to change some garments. He says, they grow old like that, and I'll change the coat. That's who the essence of our God is. That his being is something beyond the physical, beyond the time, which we know that. But again, we don't often think of it in the sense of, in light of that, his immutability. I find, again, I think it's impossible for me to understand eternity past, that he's the same God, that he will be eternity future. The physical mind, I truly believe, struggles to grasp this. Because God has no beginning and no ending, he can, if you think about just this one concept, because he has no beginning and no ending, he can know no change. He can't change because he's not bound by time. He's not bound by the creation that does change. Even the angelic realm that were created, they changed. Lucifer was once deemed perfect and righteous. Now he's not. He changed. God's not that way. There was never a time when he was not. And there never will come a time when he will cease to be. These are just phrases, for what it's worth, that I pulled out of multiple articles, both from our sites and just searching the net. It says, God has neither evolved, grown, nor improved. Now again, I got to admit, I read that, I was like, well, my initial, and you guys, I don't know if you have the same reaction, I'm like, well, he's got to have improved, right? But if you think about and really do contemplate the immutability concept, then the answer would be no. He has now, he is just as perfect in love today as he was however many trillion, bajillion, quadrillion, whatever, Google billion, squared trillion years you want to go in the past. He's the same God. That's who he is. And it'll be true eternally in the future. So he can't improve. Again, that's a foreign concept because everything I know can improve. All of us can improve. Every one of us. He can't. By definition. Because if he could, in one area, think about it, in one small, minute area, if he improved, by implication, by fact, he would have had to have not been perfect in it. Right before the improvement. So again, it's an interesting concept. This is our God. His immutability in that essence. Again, another phrase. As he is today, he has ever been and ever will be. That's why he can say, I am the Lord, I change not. We just read it in Malachi 3, verse 6. He says, I'm not changing. I am the Lord. I mean, that's a very emphatic statement. I will not change. He cannot change for the better, for he is already perfect, which you've already said. Being perfect, he cannot change for the worse. Again, I know this sounds almost esoteric, but it's important that we contemplate this. It's important because, again, we're driving to a point that does impact you and I. He is the one. He is the only one that can say, I am that I am. We know that great answer he gave when asked, who shall I say is sending me? He just simply says, I am that I am. And he's the only one that can say it. It's, you know, it's who I am. And I'm not changing. He is altogether uninfluenced by the flight of time. Again, just in many respects, just saying the same thing in different ways, because it's so important, though, that we understand and drive that concept home in our mind. Because, brethren, all creation can change. All of it. In fact, without God, all creation would change. And it would only change in one direction. It would only change for the worse. Which is another sort of concept we ought to think through. It would only change. It would only decay. Another way of saying it is we came from nothing and nature would decay us back to nothing. It is God that resists that. It is God's influence that helps you improve and get better. It's God's positive influence. It's God's positive grace. It's God's positive. It's what he's gifted us with. That allows us, quite frankly, to improve. We used to have a saying, I worked for this guy, and he had this whole book of, you know, sort of business models. And one of them, and he applied it to business, but it applies here. If it exists, it's aging. And that's true. It doesn't matter what it is. The chairs you're sitting on are decaying as you're sitting there. They just are. The tables are decaying. And, you know, it breaks the metaphor earlier, but the rocks out there, they're decaying. You know, 100 billion, 50 trillion years, I don't know. They may not be rocks. They'll be sand. Then there'll be something else. There'll be something, I don't know where it goes. Dust, space dust, I don't know. I'm not that smart. But again, Jesus is the same yesterday and today and forever. And it's something we can bank on. It's something we can hold on to. That's his essence. That's who he is. His essence and nature are infinite and subject to no mutations. So that's a big, fundamental, overarching way that which God is immutable. He is unchangeable in who he is, his essence, his core being. You know, we know him to be a family. He will, for eternity, be a family. He was eternally past a family. Still, they worked together. My wife and I were a family before I had a child. He's just now at the age where he wants to have children. And that's where we're at. We're working it out. It's kind of neat to think about it. He's going to have a family in a few short years. The second big area, and I think the latter two we wrap our minds around a lot better. He is immutable in his attributes. He is unchangeable in his demeanor, if you will. And again, I've alluded to some of them, and again, they're sort of subsets of this item. He is love. That's an attribute of God. He is perfect love. Always has been, always will be. Whatever the attributes of God were before the universe came into existence, they are precisely the same now and forever will be. Again, a verse we've already read. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It's just the way it is. Hebrews 13:8 says that, by the way. This is a necessary and provable by the perfections of his essential attributes and the quality of his being. His power is perfect. His power is perfect and unabated. His wisdom is perfect and undiminished. His holiness is perfect and unsullied. His veracity is perfect and immutable. He will never, ever lie. Ever. Ever. And we could keep saying that forever. And he'll never do it. Ever. Just for reference sake, Psalm 119, 89 through 91 says, forever, breaking into a thought, O Lord, your word is settled in heaven. Your faithfulness endures to all generations. You establish the earth and it abides. They continue this day according to your ordinances for all your servants. They continue. Your word is settled in heaven. It's just truth. His veracity will never be questioned. We mentioned this one earlier. His love is perfect and it is eternal. He's never going to stop. He always has and he always will love you. His mercy is perfect and it ceases not. Again, something I know we all hope for. I say hope more than hope. We can bank on that one. It's never going to cease. It's who he is. It's an attribute of his. It's perfect and it will never cease. Again, whatever God was eternally past, he will be eternally future, and he is right now at this very moment. It's who he is. The third overarching area I have is the immutability of his counsel, purpose, or determination. Those are just sort of synonymous terms. But whichever one I want to go with, I think I'll stick with counsel. It's immutable. His will never varies. God's purpose never alters. He is heading somewhere. He is going in a direction. And he's not changing that. Again, I think if you sort of think through some of these, and we'll get to some of the ideas, you can begin to see how this has a radical impact on our Christian walk. We are not the same. Our wills and our purpose and our determination do vary. One of two things can cause man to change his mind and reverse his plans. We have want of foresight. We don't know, we can't anticipate everything, so we have to change our course of action as we're going. It's a common thing. We all do it. Again, I think it becomes so common, we can tend to apply that to our God. And it's simply not the case. Or we lack the power to execute our plans. God is subject to neither. He can infinitively go through all permutations of what's going to happen. Now again, I can maybe guess what's going to happen in the next couple hours. We'll probably wrap up here, say some nice things, socialize a little bit, pack up, go home. We can do that. God can do this thousands and thousands of years ahead of time. That's why way early on, back in the Old Testament, he can say, hey, you know what? There's going to be a beast power at the end. There's going to be a false prophet. Because he can project out. He can plan. And he has the power to carry it out. We have neither of those. We're subject to it. So humanly, we can't do that. But God can. I want to turn back to Job. We don't often go to Job. But Job has an interesting observation on this front. Job 23, we'll just read verses 13 and 14. Job says, but he, referring to Christ or God, but he is unique, and who can make him change? And whatever his soul desires, that he does. For he performs what is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Again, his purpose for you, his will for you is eternal. Who is going, I think this verse more than anything should affect our view on prayer. Do we go to God trying to get him to change and comport to our will? Or is our prayer designed, as we are told to, not my will, but thy will be done? That's why we say, in your name, it's I want your will. Who can make him change? He is immutable in his purpose and his plan for you. Since we're back in the area, jump over to Psalms. And I meant to mention already, I know I have a lot of verses today, I apologize for that, but this topic just demands a lot of verses almost. And once you start focusing on almost everywhere you go, you see this concept. And again, if you read those words of the Bible, of Christ, and you understand his veracity, he's not going to lie to you. What you're reading has a little more depth to it. It's no longer, we might take you to dinner. Whatever. Psalms 33, start in verse 4. For the word of the Lord is right, and all his work is done in truth. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord. By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together in a heap. He lays up the deep in the storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it was done. Commanded, and it stood fast. Again, we're talking about his will, his purpose. He says it's going to be done. He commands, and it happens. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. I like that. We kind of need that right now. And hope it happens soon, I suppose, as every generation before has. But the Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He makes the plans of the people of no effect. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. Read that statement, brethren. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. Not the next 20 minutes. Not your lifetime, not your parents' lifetime, forever. The plans of his heart to all generations. That's your God. Verse 12, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people He has chosen as His own inheritance. Again, it's His will. It's His choice. He chose Israel. And brethren, He chose you. His counsel stands. He chose you. Say those words in your head and understand what we've already talked about. He is immutable. He will never change that. That's a powerful thought. And I hope it gives you an enormous amount of confidence in your Christian walk. It is without regret. We'll read that verse in a minute. It is without regret that He called you. And He opened your mind. Your God is not sorry that that happened. He spoke and it was done. Verse 13. The Lord looks from heaven and sees the sons of men. For the place of His dwelling, He looks, or from the place of His dwelling, He looks on all the inhabitants of the earth. He fashions their heart individually. Again, read that. The sons of men, He's fashioning your heart individually. He considers all their works. He's considering it. That's the whole idea, that God can, in essence, consider all the permutations of your life and everybody else's life in here and everybody else's life in this world and know where it's going and orchestrate and work out events so that you are there, that you are given every opportunity. That's an amazing thing. He fashions your heart individually and He considers all your works. Yes, including the ones you think He's not watching on and the hidden ones and the ones you hope He's not watching. He's still considering them. Turn over to Hebrews. Hebrews, and I'm going to have to get going here, aren't I? I'm going to do a lot of referencing of verses for the last 20 minutes. So, but I do want to read this one. Hebrews 6, verse 17 through 20 says, "Thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of His counsel," comes right out and says it. He said, "I want to show this to you, the heirs of promise." He wants to show the immutability of His counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things. These are two things that are completely unchangeable. Utterly unchangeable. In which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation. Brethren, I hope you do. I hope you have strong consolation in these immutable, all of God's immutable aspects. But he's saying here, by two things, who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us. See, the immutable things here he's referencing highlight two of the items we just talked about. His purpose and His essence. His counsel is immutable. We just read that in verse 17. And His veracity is immutable. He can't lie. His counsel will never change. His purposes and His intents for your life will never change. And He's not going to lie. Verse 19 says, "This hope," what we just read, that's the hope we have, and it anchors our soul. Brethren, I hope it anchors your soul. I hope it moves you. I hope it grounds you so that no matter, just, you're just as solid as that rock we talked about earlier. As the tempest of the world swirls around, and it is going to. Every one of us have our things. Every one of us leave when we go out in this world. Every one of us had trouble in the church. This anchors you. Because it gives you direction. It gives you a purpose. It gives you an end. So He's immutable in His essence, His attributes, and His purpose. Again, those are the three big umbrellas that I came up with. Maybe you come up with others. Everything else that I read fell into one of those categories. who and what God is, how his attributes, you know, again, he's a loving God. He's not going to change. It's a beautiful thing. And his intents, what his plans are, they will happen. The kingdom is coming to this earth. New Jerusalem will come to this earth. The earth will be remade. The stars of heaven are going to roll up like a scroll. His purpose will happen. We need to come now to the question. I think the question all of this leads to, and a question we ought, again, to ask in light of this. What would it mean if he could change? What would it mean to you? If anywhere in that, again, we could spend the next hours and hours and hours talking about this. But if anywhere in our God, if he could change, what would it mean to you? What would it mean if he varied as we do? If he willed one thing today and another tomorrow? What if he was controlled by caprice? Decided he wanted to change. He has the power to do it. What if he could? How would that affect you? What would it do to your relationship with God? Could you really trust him? Would you really trust him? I think, side note, but I think that's one of the reasons that the big lie of Satan is, if at his core, God changed. Even, I think we heard it in the announcement. Or, no, I was heard on a sermon on the way up here, talking about this whole concept of, how many times have you heard the term God of the Old Testament? As though that's a different God. Mm-hmm. He changed, right? There's a New Testament. It's a new covenant. Don't worry about that old thing. Those are God's laws. They were then and they still are. Now again, they were given to a nation. Some of the precepts, some of the judgments. We have to take the application and figure out how they would apply today. We don't have a nation. But the God of the Old Testament isn't some other God. What if he did change? Again, I think that's a lie that people buy into, and it just defeats and destroys their relationship with God because they wonder, will he change again? I think that's what I'd wonder if he could. What if you had questions in the back of your mind? Because I think you would. What if this time he doesn't want to hear me in my prayer? What if this time he's just too busy to take note of my request? What if one time I truly repented and he just decided it was too much work to forgive me? And he was just going to hold that one against me because, well, it's too big a sin. See, if he could change, that could happen. What if 100 million years from now he decided this whole family thing, that was just too much work? See, he's not going to do that, though. We wouldn't confide in him. The ramifications of even the awareness that he could change are profound. That's why it's the bedrock. That's why it's an anchor for our soul. It never will change. It doesn't matter what life brings your way. It doesn't matter what happens to your dying breath. He's not changing. And your purpose and your plan are sure and confident. See, I think the answer is we wouldn't stay with this outfit, to put it plain. I think, you know, we would have little hiccups along the way, but eventually we wouldn't stay. Our ability to persevere is inexorably bound to the immutability of God. It really is. Because again, if we thought just once he would change, I don't know that we'd stick with it. Maybe you would. I don't know if I would. If he were fickle, vacillating, changing in his character and plans, if today he aids his people and tomorrow he forsakes them, if at one time he loves the virtuous and another time equally loves the vicious, if he forms a plan yesterday and he abandoned it today, or if he is ever to be different a being from what he is now, we would have no encouragement, brethren. We would have no encouragement for our effort. We wouldn't know what to depend on. In fact, we couldn't depend on it. So very quickly here, and again, I'll try to reference most of these verses so you have them. Why is the immutability so fundamental? In many ways, we've been already answering a lot of this question, or this answering this question, yeah. His purpose is fixed. His will is stable, and His word is sure, brethren. The permanence of God's character guarantees fulfillment of His promise. And I'll just read this one to you. Isaiah 54:10. For the mountains shall depart and the hills be removed, but My kindness shall never depart from you, nor shall My covenant of peace be removed, says the Lord. It does matter. As I alluded to earlier, brethren, God's calling is without regret. He's not sorry. I do want to read this one because it's such a impactful moment, I think, for all of us to consider, especially when we're going through difficulties, especially when, you know, we go off the reservation. We all do. I mean, I haven't met anybody that I'm close with that opens up that doesn't say they go through cycles. You know, kind of hot and cold. We vacillate. We change. So I want to read this one. So if you would turn back to Romans chapter 11. Romans chapter 11, verse 29. And again, it's a short verse, but I do want you to see it. I want you to read it. Not I. I'm sound like I'm telling you what to do. I'm not. I just think it's helpful to read the words. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. That is your immutable God. You are here because God purposed it. Not because you're smart. Not because you're good looking. Not because you're rich. Not because you're poor. It was His determination. And He is not sorry He did it. He thought ahead. He planned. And you're here for a purpose. It was a willful, thoughtful, intentional act. But in that, brethren, we must understand that we are the free moral agents. In the whole of this process, we, not our parents, not our child, not our spouse, we are the only one that can break this whole chain, break God's purpose, because of the free moral agents that we are. We can cause the whole system not to work. And in that, again, is enormous confidence. But I think a healthy fear. I think it ties right into what the Bible would call the fear of the Lord. It's not exactly the same, but it's in that vein. And it doesn't matter who you are, who we all are. When time is done, everyone will be there because of free will choice on our part. But He will do it. He will perform His side. He will make it available to everybody. And everybody that's not there will have chosen to not be there. And it doesn't matter what horrible character you pull up in history. It is a choice they will make. Turn over, if you would, to 1 Peter. And I'm going to read it. I keep looking at these things. Oh, I've got to read that one. We'll see how far we get through this, but we will end on time. 1 Peter chapter 1. Verse 17. For what it's worth, 1 Peter is a great book to read for the immutability of God, the whole book. 1 Peter 1:17. And if you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourself throughout the time of your stay here in fear, knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things. Again, we're not redeemed with corruptible things. We have a certain unchangeable bedrock, the corruption. It is a changeable thing. It's not. That's not what you've been redeemed with. Again, our redemption is not silver, not gold. It is an unchangeable, corruptible thing. I'll reread verse 18 since I stopped in the middle. Knowing that you were not redeemed with corruptible things like silver, gold from your aimless conduct received by the tradition from your fathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, of a lamb without blemish, without spot. That's what you've been redeemed from, brethren. And that is what you have to fix your feet firmly on. And the nice thing is, again, with the topic we're talking about today, it will never shift. It will never change. And again, I know we know that. But does it move our life? Does it give us the confidence we need to carry on the next day and the next day? Your inheritance. See, these are another implication for you and me on the immutability of God. Your inheritance is eternal. Whatever experiences you have in this life, good or bad, up or down, it is all temporary. And to keep with the terminology we're using today, it's all corruptible. It's all changing. You know, as you go through life, the older you get, the more you realize. It's like work comes and goes. People you like working with, they come and go. People that are horribly difficult to work with come and go. Family dynamics change. Kids grow up. They go through bad phases. They go through good phases. It's all changing. But whatever it is, we have an inheritance, incorruptible at the end. Again, just since we're there, let's turn back to 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. It says, "Blessed be the God of our Father and our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to His abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible." There it is. Your inheritance is incorruptible. It is unchanging. And I know I've said that 100 times probably by now today. But I really want us to leave this message and get this point. There are things that are so solid, so bedrock, so core, so unchangeable, so incorruptible, that you can bank everything you've got on it. Everything. I'm going to skip over a lot of these and just reference them. Just for references, 1 Peter 5 verse 4 says, "And when Christ, or when the chief shepherd appears, you shall receive the crown of glory that does not fade away." What a great vision. I like that he says, "You shall receive it." I think another area that we cannot just not highlight. The immutability of God assures standards. That gets back to the commandments. It assures those. He's not going to change them. Again, murder is wrong. In every situation, at all times, universally, for eternity. It is and was. It always will be. Lying, the same way. You're not going to lie 100 trillion years from now. It's never going to be okay. It's never going to be acceptable. God's word is unchangeable. Again, I'll just read this to you. 1 Peter 1, 22. "Since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart, having been born again, not of corruptible seed," again, there's that concept, "not of the corruptible seed, but the incorruptible, through the word of God which lives and abides forever." The word of God lives and abides. I believe 100 million years from now, we'll still have these words. We'll still look at them. Because they're going to be forever. That probably won't be on electronics and paper form. But the words will still be there. It will not change. Verse 24, "Because all flesh is as grass, and the glory of man is the flower of the grass." Again, juxtaposing the permanence of one and the changeableness of the other. "The grass withers, and the flower falls away. But the word of the Lord endures forever." Not until the millennium's over. Forever. It endures. This is one of the reasons, brethren, we teach what's in the book. We strive to open that book every day. We strive every time we give message, every time we study. That's what we go to. We may read other things, but we line it up to that. Others may change that. We will not. That is not part of the Church of God's stand. We will look in there. And again, it is Old and New Testament. one final element. We may take a few extra minutes here, but one final element we cannot ignore. Because, brethren, herein lies the awesome core, the awesome essence, if you will, of the fear of the Lord. This is it. He will never, ever accept sin. Never. A half a degree. Again, last time I talked about true north. A half a degree, a hundredth of a degree, is still not the narrow way. If we're off, He will never accept that. That's why we, the changeable, are always looking for and angling toward and headed toward the perfection. That's the Christian walk. He will never accept sin. And what we think, especially when I was young, I wouldn't admit it then, but we always think there's a way around it. We can be the exception to the rule. Maybe this time I can get away with X. It's not going to happen. It will never change. We need to understand on this one a fundamental truth. All sin is judged or it's forgiven. There are no other options. If we do not get on our knees, if we do not constantly, regularly look for ways we're off the narrow path and seek forgiveness and repentance and get back on the path, then the sin will be judged. We don't have to like it, but this is the fear of the Lord to me. He's not going to change because He likes you a lot. Again, He's not going to change because, you had a hard life. That may all be true. He understands it, and He understands a lot. I mean, again, some of us have had better lives than others. I get it. I've had a great life. My parents loved me. We had a great life. I like my family. I know people that don't. I know people that have had a very bad life. But He's not going to make it okay to sin, ever. All sin will be judged or forgiven. It's a phrase we ought to stick in the back of our heads. And there will be no exceptions. You can read this. We won't take time, but if you have notes, go back and read the first couple of books or chapters of Jeremiah. I just took a few excerpts out, specifically chapter 2, 1 through 13. You see a God. He's like, this is who I am. I did all of this. And here's what you did. And He culminates, and you read chapter 2, 3, 4. He culminates with this, and I will just read this to you. Jeremiah 4, 28 says, For this shall the earth mourn, and the heavens above be black, because I have spoken, I have purpose, I will not relent, I will not turn back. He's talking about the judgment that will come. See, brethren, there is a time for forgiveness. There's a time and an opportunity to be forgiven of your sins. And there is a time when it's done. And judgment is upon the people. At this point in Jeremiah, it's on the city of Jerusalem, Judah in general. We see in Revelation that time is yet to come upon all mankind. We live now in a time where forgiveness is being offered. You can read the wrap-up. You can read the prophecies of how God's going to wrap up the end time. And there's coming a time when the door is shut. There's coming a time of judgment. And the hard one to wrap our minds around is the God who is perfect, unchangeable love is the one that's going to be doing the judgment. And millions of people are going to die. But He's still a God of love. And it does take some thought to think through that. Because it's very easy to jump to the conclusion, wow, He's just a mean God. I actually want to give a whole sermon on just that topic. He's not a mean God. He's still a God of love. And judgment is actually a loving thing. Again, read the first couple chapters of Jeremiah. It is, and it's very instructive in light of what many of us suspect we're heading toward. And at some point, whether it's our generation, our kids, or our grandkids, or the great-grandkids, somebody's going through what's in the book of Revelation, in the book of Daniel, and what was talked about in the Sermon on the Mount. Brethren, I find this concept, again, there's so much more that could be talked about, so much more that could be said, but I find great comfort in the immutability of God. Because humans may be unstable as water. Your friends may be fickle. Your family may not understand. They may change. They may do a lot of things. Nations will come and nations will go. Land and sea may shift. Heavens may roll up like a scroll, which we know someday will. But God will not change. Brethren, He's the rock. And in the midst of an ever-changing world, you can rely on that. You can bank on that. He will never be unloving. He will never be unjust. He will never be unfair. He will never be unforgiving. He will never be unkind. He will never be untruthful. He will never be unmerciful. And on it goes. Because He is immutable. He is unchangeable. He is the perfection of all those. Brethren, His plans are sure. His purpose will succeed. His promise is secure. The law is unalterable. His precepts are everlasting. His veracity is unassailable. The question I want to leave you all with today. In light of His immutability, in light of the immutability of our God, how should you conduct yourself through your remaining time in your pilgrimage? I want to ask you to consider that. And I'll even tell you where to find the answer. Read 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 17. It's a launching point, but it will give you the answer of how to conduct yourself